welcome Sonoma to Wine Biz. It's Monday, and in the studio, so this is Randy, and in the studio with me for the first time together at last, Mr. Tom Wark. Tom, how you doing today?
Good, Randy. Thanks for having me on. I feel bad. I let Kaz down 3 weeks ago, but it was unavoidable, but I was properly chided.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you've this is your makeup day, so we're counting on, you know, some good times. So actually, Kaz couldn't make it today. He had to basically be off doing his football thing again because, you know, he does the football coaching. So, you know, we just give him some... I give him those days. So I'll be here this week, and I will also be on next week.
Well, as it should be, football first.
Football first?
Yes.
You a big football fan?
Actually, I'm not, but I understand the Kaz is. I don't want to upset him any more than I already have.
Yeah,
so,
no kidding.
Kaz, that was for you.
Yeah. I used to be a big football fan, but not so much.
You know, I stopped being a football fan when the Raiders moved away. I think in the 70s, wasn't it?
You were so hurt by Al Davis that you
actually
said,
I was hurt, you know, and then I just stuck with baseball, and this season I'm hurting.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, Giants! Yeah, Giants. Oh, rough. That's a rough year. Okay, but this isn't about baseball or football. This is about wine. This is Wine Biz, and the phone lines, of course, are open. The number to call, local 933-9133, or if you don't happen to live in the beautiful Sonoma Napa Valleys, you live outside, you can call 707-933-9133. We don't give 800 numbers out here. Nah. You pay your dime. Okay, so we're getting off to a great start. Wanted to go ahead and, you know, last week I did this for the first time where we did kind of the headlines of the day.
The wine headlines.
And so, and I just do my own little kind of take on some of the things and then repackage it and call it Wine Biz Weekly. So without any further ado, let's do Wine Biz Weekly for August 20th, 2007. So to start things off, it's Thunderdome at Grape Radio. Okay, not exactly. But the guys at Grape Radio do go mano a mano on the topic of wine scores. In their August 13th episode, the guys explore reasons why small wineries would submit wines to be reviewed and whether the possible benefit of a high score counterbalances the risk of a low one. Several good points are raised by all the Grape Radio panelists, even though 34 minutes later, nobody walks away having changed anyone else's mind. Nevertheless, it lays bare some of the issues that confront new wineries as they try to rise above the noise in order to catch the attention of consumers. You can have a listen at graperadio.com. Now, you've listened to Grape Radio, don't you?
I sure do. I like those guys down there. They do a great job.
Did you listen to this particular one?
No, I didn't, but I've been involved in this discussion for quite some time. Yeah. I'm actually my day job is a publicist, and so I get questioned all the time, should we be sending our wines into, you know, Parker, Spectator, Tanzer, and those folks? And
sure.
I can't think of a good reason not to.
Yeah, in fact, that's the primarily one of the big arguments of this was there's actually really no downside. They don't think there's a downside, or at least some of them didn't think there was a real downside to getting an 82 or an 85 score. It's like, well, so what? You're no worse off than you were already.
I mean, that's true. And the fact is, it's if you're making wines that get scored 82 by anybody, you probably shouldn't be in the business. You're likely, anyone, even if they're making average wine, they're going to get 85, 86, 87, and that's not going to affect your marketing. However, what if you were to pull off a 92 or a 93 or a 94? All of a sudden, you can call up your publicist and fire them because you don't need them anymore.
Right, yeah. So. Yeah, because the Robert Parker or Wine Spectator becomes your publicist for you.
That's right.
Yeah. So moving on. Yeah, that was a good one. Inertia Beverage Group's Rethink Wine Blog is championing RFID in wine. Did you read this? This is an August 14th post. Shows up by, I think his name's Siney George. Advocating the use of RFID technology to help prevent wine piracy and resale fraud. He mentions that embedding RFID tags in natural cork closures can help maintain and verify the provenance of a particular bottle of wine. And considering the expanding set of features that RFID could provide, the future could see temperature sensors embedded in the cork so that when you wave the little RFID sensor over the top of the closed bottle, you can read the maximum and minimum temperatures the bottle's been exposed to.
Wow.
The only trick to this, The only trick to this brave new world of wine is how to get the RFID sensor into natural cork closures. Because, at least in the highly collectible kind of level of wine, synthetic closures are still a non-starter.
Does it have to be a synthetic cork in order to make it work, or can you put it natural?
The trick is how to get it in there. I don't think anybody's kind of worked out how to get the little RFID sensors to be in the cork without compromising it or something.
I wonder how big the RFID sensors must be, because if you can make them fairly small, I wonder if you can place them elsewhere that would be easier to implement them.
Possibly.
And there's other implications here, too. I mean, they can basically track that bottle, can't they?
Yes.
I mean, from wherever it goes.
That's what they mean by the provenance, is that, you know, if you wave the ID over it, or you wave the little sensor and it says, this bottle, you know, was transferred to this person, to that person, to the other person, and so you have a chain of custody pretty much for collectible wine.
Is there any way to implement a procedure where you can track the location of that bottle using RFID?
No, that's really only when you can get it under a sensor. Now, you know.
See, I don't mind people knowing, you know, where the wine has been, but I just don't like the idea of people knowing where and when I'm drinking my wine, because that's really a private matter for
me. Privacy advocates always go after RFID too, for exactly that reason, is that, you know, there's the possibility of, Big Brother kind of mentality of not being able to control who's checking what you're doing.
But in a lot of cases, hasn't that horse left the barn? I mean, for example, in places like Walmart and Target and other very, very large retail chains, they've got barcodes, and they know exactly what you've bought.
Oh, yeah.
They know on what day you've bought it. They know how much you paid for it. Now, they're not supposed to necessarily use that information or sell that information, but they do have that information.
Yes,
so
indeed.
There are some folks out there who know some very strange purchasing patterns that I have, I'm sure.
I don't even want to know what those purchasing patterns are. All right. So anyhow, you can actually take a look at this yourself. You go to blog.inertiabev.com. inertiabev.com. Okay, next story. This is getting good. Man, this is like sweet. If you thought cork taint, or TCA, or corked wine, whatever you want to call it, was bad, watch out. This story comes to us by way of Gabriela Opas at catavino.net, who quotes an article at newscientist.com where wine and grape juice tainted with wasp venom caused allergic reactions in 5 people in Spain, one of whom went into anaphylactic shock due to drinking the stuff. They finally determined that the venom most likely got into the juice and new wine by the little buggers getting caught and crushed in the grape press when the fruit was first processed. Yum. And you might ask, well, if that's so, why is this the first time I've ever heard about this? As it turns out, the venom is highly volatile and breaks down even only after a few weeks of aging. So the fair warning is, don't forget to lay down your new wine if you're allergic to bee stings.
I guess we need to have a new warning label on the wines, don't we?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, you know, if FDA catches wind of that, boy. Ooh. If the FDA is listening to this, don't take that.
Yeah, ignore that altogether.
Ignore.
But somebody, please do something about corked wines.
Yeah.
Please.
In fact, I was just looking at another story I'll talk about in a sec. Another Appalachian America story about closures. So actually, this is a fun one. The Pinot blogger sells out to Robert Parker. Intrepid winery owner and industry blogger Josh Hermsmeyer, who is also, of course, a friend of the show, was caught on film or digicam or whatever you call it, wearing a shirt proclaiming himself to be Robert Parker's, let's just say, love slave, shall we?
Starts with a B and ends with an H, doesn't it?
It sure does. The Wine Broad's board, I love that name, exposed Josh as the shameless scoremonger he truly is as he grins savagely at the camera while pawing an issue of Wine and Spirits. How low can you go, Josh? How low can you go?
Well, I know who put him up to that, too. And you ought to have her on this show sometime.
We should. Yeah. But what the heck? It's an opportunity to give the man a plug, and I'm okay with that. Go see his blog at pinotblogger.com. And also make sure to check out the Wine Broad's board at winebroad.typad.com. Since the broad behind it, Tina Caputo, is a wine writer and has a sense of humor that runs right up my alley. I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah, her blog is fantastic. I just discovered that blog maybe about a week ago.
Yeah.
And Tina's been in the business forever, and she's the managing editor at Wines and Vines magazine, and she knows the underbelly of this industry too. So whenever she wants to come forth with some fun nuggets, she's going to be the source of those for sure.
Cool. Yeah, we should work. I mean, I found out about it from Josh's blog, so that's why I was like, oh, this is interesting. I mean, and she'd posted that back in like, you know, July sometime.
It was back. Yeah, I know.
So it was like an old. I was like, this is such a beautiful piece of journalism. How could you possibly like not have that?
But I want one of the T-shirts.
I know. I actually posted a comment on that. I said, I got to have me one of these.
Josh should sell them at his site. He's not selling wine yet, so he should at least sell T-shirts.
He should, because he would sell out. He couldn't keep those in stock. And finally, this week, you're going to laugh at this one. Len Thompson emailed me last week to settle the dispute over how to pronounce the name of his blog. I mention you as the author of Fermentation, the daily wine blog at fermentation.typepad.com, and of course, friend of the show. You say it rhymes with devour as in Godzilla devouring Tokyo.
That's what I thought.
Whereas I tend to think of it as rhyming with endeavor as in the shuttle.
Len
gives up the answer. The blog's working title was originally Len's Adventures, later transforming to Len's Endeavors, and then to Lendevers, even spelled with the extra A to match Endeavor. So I win.
So it's Lendevers.
But hold on just a minute. He continued on to say that when he decided to focus on food and wine, he changed the spelling by dropping the A, making it Lendevours.
No.
So he now claims that both pronunciations are correct, settling the argument between you and me for now, but not really earning any extra credit for brand management. And that. Oh, and the last thing about Lendevers or Lendevours, whatever you want to call it, is that he finally posted the Wine Blogging Wednesday recap for the Naked Chardonnay.
Really? Unwooded?
So, so he that was last month's Wine Blogging Wednesday, and it went through. He said there are 32 wines.
Oh, there's more and more. I love those wines,
32
too.
Bloggers. I mean, in many cases, each blog did several. So it was
right.
Like, yeah,
I love the unwooded Chardonnays so much because they tend to be maybe a little bit lower in alcohol, but they got that fruity punch. They tend to retain the acidity.
Real nice acidity, yeah. Exactly.
I love that trend. I do. There's a few people in this neck of the woods who make one too. Mayo makes one, and then, who's the other one who I came across in this neck of the woods? Can't remember. Look, find them.
Think about it.
Find them.
You work it out. Actually, I wanted to go ahead and talk next about this Appalachian America article. It's called "To Screw Cap Wine Bottles or Not: Sensible Answers to a Debate Gone Public," and so it's an interview, but it's largely the question of obviously corked wines being the chief reason to investigate either synthetic cork or screw top, and in a lot of cases, there's people that ask if the wine is closed with a screw top, does that mean it's like a cheap wine? And that's absolutely not the case anymore. A lot of the choices, there's actually even via this article, there's actually a screw cap that allows a limited amount of like micro oxidation to occur.
To simulate natural cork.
To simulate natural cork.
Yeah.
But that in the case of this particular winery, which I think is Tabias Creek.
Tablas Creek?
Tablas. Oh, it's with an
Paso
L,
Robles?
Sorry. Yeah. So they were saying that, they've looked at that, but they don't think it's been used enough to kind of justify trying it out in a real sense. I mean, they might be experimenting with it just to see how well wine lays down with those kind of closures on it.
The real problem that wineries have is the perception that a twist off means the wine in the bottle is a lesser wine or an inferior wine. So regardless of what the reality is, you have to deal with this market perception. And it was very, very brave of, I believe it was Plumpjack over in Napa, probably about 7 or 8 years ago when Twist Offs first came out. Plumpjack made a reserve wine, and they sold it, I think, for $150 a bottle. And so they bottled half of it with Twist Offs, and they bottled half of it with corks. And that was sort of their way of saying, hey, Twist Offs can be really fine wines. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of taken off since then, certainly among white wines.
Right. No, absolutely. Yeah. Anything that's like a, drink it in the next couple years,
absolutely.
You see a lot of that now.
Although I'd love to see a study or at least a taste a few wines. Red wines that have been under screw cap and under cork for 10 years and see if there's any real significant difference.
Right.
That would be interesting. And I haven't really seen any significant studies on that either.
I mean, how long has screw caps like really started to be used in the industry for like really high end? I mean, it could be that there are wineries out there that bottle a few representative cases with screw tops and then put it away,
mm-hmm.
and then they'll bring out their reserve, how many years later, and then they'll actually do exactly what you mentioned.
I'm sure they're doing that.
Yeah, I gotta believe that anybody who's got it, and if you aren't, get started.
But we can do that experiment with white wines, because there are some white wines that will age for up to 10 years. A nice Burgundy. I don't know if I've seen any Burgundies under screw cap, though. Even some well-made Sauvignon Blancs actually can last that long. In fact, I've been drinking some 96 Sauvignon Blancs, some of which are good, some of which are over the hill. But so you can sort of do that experiment with a screw cap and a white if you wanted to. Maybe even just looking 5 years out would be enough.
Possibly. And if you think about it from an oxidation point of view, if you're using one of the really tight closure seals that don't let any air in, I mean, couldn't that increase the shelf life of white wines?
I don't know the chemical nature of the way wine breaks down. I'm sure it does in one way or another. But it'd be anyone out there who's got a bottle of white wine, both with cork and with a screw cap, same vintage, same wine, please bring it in. We'd be happy to try it.
No problem. We won't stop you. Yeah, that's one of the more interesting ones.
Where was that story?
That was AppalachianAmerica.com. So it's wine.appalachianamerica. It's a good story. It just came out today. So
boy, they're rocking too. Yeah, Appalachian America.
It's a great site.
Wow,
They're starting to be like the go-to online resource for kind of what's going on.
And they cover everything. They'll cover Missouri wine and Michigan wine, New York wine, California wine.
Well, hence the name, right?
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
They declared themselves. There was actually a press release this morning. Iron Horse Vineyards named an American icon.
By who?
It was a Random House Coffee Table reference book. It's called Icons of the American Marketplace, Consumer Brand Excellence. Published at the end of July. They're one of three wineries that were put in.
Do they name the others?
Yes, they do. The others, the other one is Gallo.
I'd buy that.
And the other is Manischewitz.
No. No, that's not right.
You would think, I was kind of thinking, I'm like, come on, there's got to be wine brands in here that have to be able to trump folks like Iron Horse.
Well, where's Robert Mondavi?
Exactly.
Where's Kendall Jackson? I mean, I can see those. Where's Glen Ellen Winery, which was the first one to really push the fighting varietal notion.
Or Sutter Home.
Or Sutter Home, Saved Zinfandel.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Manischewitz?
I don't know. Yeah. Fortified wine.
And not anything against Iron Horse. I mean, Iron Horse makes a killer sparkling wine. And they just released, I had a Chardonnay from them that was extraordinary, a Green Valley Chardonnay. But icon, I mean, Superman is an icon. Coca-Cola is an icon.
Exactly. And they mention it's like, oh, we're in the same kind of tier or same company as Coca-Cola and other big brands. I'm thinking, Iron Horse? Now, as you said, I've been on a pink wine kick all summer, and I actually tried their Rosato di Sangiovese, and it was very good. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was like, wow, this is pretty good stuff. I didn't even know who Iron Horse was. That tells you, okay, you know, when I look at a bottle of Coca-Cola, I know what it is. If I see Gallo of Sonoma, I know what that is. If I see, you know, but Iron Horse, I had no idea what Iron Horse was.
Well, they've been around for a long time out in Green Valley. Forrest Hanser is the owner. Mm-hmm. And again, they make killer sparkling wine, and they have for a long time. But if you're going to choose a sparkling wine producer, I'm thinking maybe Korbel.
Or Mumm,
exactly.
I mean, yeah.
I agree 100%. Well, is Manischewitz, do they make Manischewitz in the United States?
I have no idea. I think so.
Because it's kosher, isn't it?
I believe so.
But you don't need to make it anywhere. You can easily, yeah. Well, that's so interesting. Good for Iron Horse.
Hey, yeah. Grats to them. I mean, it was one of those like, wow, that's really good job.
I'd have done the press release too if it weren't one of my clients.
Yeah.
Why not?
Sure. So yeah, that was the fun stories of the last week and then this morning. So yeah. But anyway, what do you think about the Wine Biz Weekly, this little summary thing that I just
It's important that you do that sort of thing. And the people who are listening to this show, you guys are either in the business or interested in wine, and you need to know these headlines. I mean, how many of you knew, for example, that Iron Horse is now an
American icon?
You do now.
You
so
do, yeah.
It's a good idea.
As Kaz would say, you need your number two pencils because this we give out a lot of info here. I mean, we do. And actually, with this, I started last week, and Kaz just was blown away. But he's like, oh, my God, that's great.
Well, I love the idea that you're looking at blogs, too, because it strikes me that wine blogs have really become a source of immediacy in the world of wine news. And so if you can handle looking at all the right wine blogs and somehow put together a system whereby you can track them, you're going to get your hands on a lot of interesting subjects.
And quickly, too. I mean, it's like literally the case in point is this American icon thing for Iron Horse came up just this morning at 6. It came over the wires at 6:30 this morning. So it's like that's pretty new. All right. So actually, we were going to since the phone's been ringing off the hook all day, Once again, to remind you, if you want to call in and join the conversation, local call is 933-9133. And if you're outside the area, just put a 707 in front of that, 707-933-9133. I'm not going to go – Kaz goes nuts with the phone number all hour long, and I just can't stand that. So I only just do it once every 20 minutes. And if you don't call in, you don't call in. Anyhow, yeah, so the big reason we wanted Tom is as part of his makeup day, because when he wasn't here, he was in Illinois, and he was in the midst of a heated battle. And he's nodding his head like, yeah. And so without any really further ado, I think we're going to launch into kind of a discussion of Illinois and their HB 429. This is their kind of, you know, the law prohibiting wine retailers, mm-hmm. outside, out-of-state wine retailers. So why don't we give that one a start?
Well, one thing I can recommend is nobody gets stuck in the Springfield, Illinois airport for 8 hours. They have neither Wi-Fi access, and they have one vending machine in the form of food. Ooh. So that's why I was not here, I guess it was 2 or 3 weeks ago, was because I had to go to Illinois to deal with this direct shipping issue. And I had planned to call in, but I had no reception. I had no nothing. So, again, I need to apologize for Kaz. But the state of Illinois recently enacted legislation that will prohibit all out-of-state wine retailers from shipping in to that state. Meanwhile, Illinois retailers are still allowed to ship to Illinoisans. And if that sounds familiar to any winemakers or wine lovers who might be listening, it should. Beginning in about 1993, we began a series of battles that culminated in a Supreme Court decision called Granholm v. Heald. And that decision dealt with the issue of, may a state prohibit business entities from outside the state from shipping into their consumers. The Supreme Court said, no, you may not do that. You have to put both in-state businesses and out-of-state businesses on the same playing field. However, that didn't stop the state of Illinois and a number of other states, including the state of California, from actually enacting legislation since that Supreme Court decision that prohibited out-of-state wine retailers from shipping into a state. So what we're finding, we're in the midst of essentially the same battle, but now it's not with regard to wineries, it's with regard to wine retailers. And with the advent of the internet and with so many people going online to purchase their fine and rare wines and looking for the best price, it's a significant issue, not just for retailers, but for consumers.
Yeah, I you know, clearly one of the retailers I'm sure is part of this is Wine Library.
Gary Vaynerchuk.
Gary Vaynerchuk.
Yeah, he is. He's on our board of directors. I'm the executive director of the Specialty Wine Retailers Association, which was the reason why I was out there for that.
Right, and I know that if you spent any time on Wine Library's website or the Wine Library TV websites, their forums were like ablaze with lots of discussion about this. Lots of Illinois wine enthusiasts were on those boards griping about the fact that they're not going to be able to get the wine where they want to get it. So,
yeah, and the reason they were griping is in the case of Illinois consumers have been able to purchase and have shipped to them wine from out-of-state retailers for 15 years now. Illinois, because of this Supreme Court decision in 2005, Illinois was forced to change their laws to make them compatible with the Constitution as it was enunciated by the Supreme Court. And in the course of doing that, they stripped consumers of the right to purchase wine from out-of-state retailers. And so that's why Illinois retailers were so upset about this. A lot of these people had been buying wine, you know, on the internet or from out-of-state retailers who specialized in rare and fine wines for over a decade, and now they won't be able to do that anymore. But it should be said that Illinois is not the first state to have done this.
Oh, yeah?
No, as a matter of fact, they're not. In 2005, California passed a law that allowed out-of-state wineries to get a permit from the state of California that would allow them to ship wine to Californians. I think the out-of-state wineries need to pay $50. They need to agree to submit themselves to California jurisdiction, and they need to remit taxes to the state of California if they ship wine into this state directly to a consumer. All that's very reasonable. However, in the course of passing that law, they prohibited out-of-state retailers from shipping into California. And the reason they did that was because of the power of California's wholesalers, who took the opportunity of a change in California law to protect their own interests in California, and in the process, screw consumers.
Right. So okay, so clearly California's been down this road that Illinois just kind of has jumped themselves into the same kind of track. How was this resolved for California?
Well, we sued the state of California.
Well, there you
go. We sued them, and we basically said, you can't allow in-state retailers to ship to California and exclude out-of-state retailers from doing the same. That's not in compliance with the Constitution. It's not in compliance with the Granholm v. Heald Supreme Court decision on wine shipping. So we sued the state of California, and we got an agreement from the California ABC. The ABC agreed not to enforce this law against out-of-state retailers for a period of 2 years, during which they would we agreed that we would pursue a change in the law that would allow Californians to purchase wine from out-of-state retailers. We had our first hearing on that issue, I think back in June it was, in the California Senate, and that went real well. So SWRA will be floating a bill in the next session, in the 2008 session, and we hope to be able to get that through. But we're going to have to fight against wholesalers who are protecting their turf, quite intensely.
Yeah, and this is the wholesale distribution channel that's been in existence ever since Prohibition was repealed, right?
After Prohibition, most states in the United States enacted something called the three-tier system. And what the three-tier system is actually fairly simple. It's a law that says a producer of an alcoholic beverage must sell to a wholesaler or a distributor, and that distributor or wholesaler must then sell only to a retailer or a restaurateur who then sells it to you and I. And the reason they put that in place is they didn't want to see the same problems that developed before Prohibition, where producers exerted an enormous amount of pressure and influence over retailers. So they thought if they stick this wholesaler tier between the producer and the retailer, they would take care of that. But imagine this for a second. Imagine if there was a law in California that stated that before any news could be presented to consumers, it had to first go through community radio.
Nice.
Very nice, huh? Very, very nice.
That'd please us, but
that's right.
Good.
You'd fight to, sure, to maintain that law. And that's exactly what the wholesalers are doing, because what's happened is, as a result of us having this sort of an hourglass market where all the wine that can be sold in the state funnels through a wholesaler, they've become extraordinarily powerful as a result of making extraordinary amounts of money. Those extraordinary amounts of money have allowed them to essentially purchase influence.
Right. They build up a war chest, and
exactly,
then they can spend it however they
want. And they use it to protect their monopoly
status. Just like
status.
Any other entrenched kind of, any incumbent that already has the high ground, and it's tough.
Exactly. So what they do is when the opportunity to change laws arise, the wholesalers they wield their power, and a lot of times, most times actually, legislators at the state level will do their bidding. And so California legislators did their bidding and stripped California consumers of the right to buy wine from out-of-state retailers. It happened in Texas. It happened in Illinois. There was an attempt in Oregon to do that. There was an attempt in New Mexico to do that. Next year, we expect there will be an attempt to do that also in Iowa and Florida, at least.
And then, of course, the battle here in California in terms of
and the battle here in California will be a legislative one, and
right,
it'll be interesting. So far that we know that the California Wine Institute, the Family Winemakers of California, as well as us specialty wine retailers, all support this legislation. Southern Wine and Spirits, which is the most powerful distributor in the state, opposes this legislation. And there are actually a few wholesalers, distributors in California who don't oppose this legislation, and that's good news. So we have to do some real footwork and some education in order to get this thing passed for consumers.
No, that's a good sign. If the wholesaler kind of tier doesn't if they're not kind of close ranks on the issue, that it actually improves the odds.
Well, we are in California. I mean, California is the state that where wineries and wine consumers tend to have the most power. For obvious reasons, the industry here is very, very strong. However, just in terms of campaign contributions, even in California, wine distributors match the amount of money they give to state legislators as the wine industry gives. So,
yeah.
And that's extraordinarily uncommon. In most states, Illinois is a perfect example. Since 2000, they've given $5.4 million to legislators.
Wow.
Yeah. And the wine, it's and they've purchased a great deal of power.
Sure. I mean, yeah, in comparison. So I guess we want to make sure that we drive home the point that this issue with Illinois does actually matter to California folks.
In a number of different ways. Certainly any wine retailer in this neck of the woods has to be concerned with this. There are some great wine retailers in this town. I mean, the Wine Exchange, Taylor and Norton. I mean, mm-hmm. just to begin with, these guys, they have a national market that they serve, and they've been serving that national market for quite some time. The Illinois portion of their market will now go away. So for them, it's extraordinarily important. For consumers in California, unless we pass legislation that allows you to purchase wines from out of state, you will no longer be able to go online and look for the best price on a rare or fine wine. It'll be against the law because no one will be able to ship it to you.
Right.
So it's really a national battle that's happening now. I mean, the wholesalers lost the battle with regard to wineries, and what they're claiming is that the Supreme Court decision Granholm v. Heald did not apply to retailers. It only applied to wineries, they say, because it was the wineries who were the litigants and brought the suit. But I think Granholm was quite clear that it applies not just to wineries who want to ship direct, but also to retailers. But we apparently have to win that battle in court, and so that's what we're doing.
Okay. Actually, I was just thinking about that because it was the question of if you have the wineries are free to ship and the retailers. How do you prevent wine? You know, what about wine distributors? I mean, do we even care about that?
You know, in California, wine distributors may ship directly to consumers.
Really?
We have the most liberal laws of any state. California, anybody can ship and sell to anybody else. They tend not to. Distributors make their living moving boxes. They don't really make their living selling wine.
Shipping wine directly to people.
Exactly.
I mean, they're used to filling trucks full of wine and shipping them around.
And they're great at
supermarkets and restaurants, et cetera.
They're just wonderful at that. Yeah. But California has very liberal laws, and we're the exception to the rule out here. But the issue at hand is whether this Supreme Court decision, Granholm versus Heald, actually applies to retailers. And it just so happens, Randy, that I brought in a snippet from that decision.
Oh.
So.
Ooh. This ought to be the part where everybody has a nap. Okay, people, put your heads on your desks.
Well, actually, it's interesting because the Granholm v. Heald Supreme Court decision dealt with two different issues. It dealt with the issue of the Commerce Clause and with the 21st Amendment, which was the repeal of prohibition. And just to remind everyone, the 21st Amendment, the repealed prohibition, did something else too. It stated unequivocally that states have the right to control the sale and distribution of wine inside their borders. However, the Commerce Clause of the United States says that a state may not erect barriers to trade so that you have these interstate trade wars.
Sure.
It was there to create sort of an open free market in the United States so that, you know, tariffs and levies weren't put in place to protect in-state businesses. So there's a clash of interests there. And the Supreme Court decision, Granholm v. Heald, was one in a long series of decisions that spoke to that issue. And what the Supreme Court decided was that a state may, in fact, regulate how wine is sold and distributed inside their state as long as out-of-state businesses are put on the same and level playing field. Now, did the Granholm decision apply directly to wineries, or did it have broader implications, and did it apply to both retailers and wineries? So I have to read this to you.
All right.
This is from Granholm v. Heald, 2005. Anthony Kennedy, writing for the courts, writes, state laws violate the Commerce Clause if they mandate differential treatment that benefits in-state entities but burdens out-of-state entities.
Did they use the word entities in the decision?
No, I use entities. They use businesses.
All right.
And then they have this long list of different cases that they list.
Got it. Okay. So you're paraphrasing and shorthanding, but that's good.
I'm taking out the case law that they cite. Okay. But this rule is essential to the foundation of the union. The mere fact of non-residence should not foreclose a producer in one state from access to markets in another. Here comes the good quote. States may not enact laws that burden out-of-state producers or shippers simply to give a competitive advantage to in-state businesses, producers or shippers.
Yeah, if that's in the decision, that's pretty clear.
Well, you have to ask yourself, what's a shipper?
Right.
Is a shipper a common carrier? if it means that common carriers must be allowed to ship into the state, that makes me happy because I just give the wine off to a common carrier and they can legally send it in there.
Right.
If it doesn't apply to common carriers, then what's the difference between a producer and a shipper? We know there's a difference because they use the word or.
Right.
I'm thinking it's retailers.
You think?
I'm thinking.
Yeah. That's great that just that little two extra words or shippers and
well,
then suddenly – but now it's clear that, I'm sure that the wholesale kind of lobby is going to be big on what the definition of a shipper is, and they're going to try and be as narrow as possible.
Actually, they simply say no. I'm sorry. It just applied to wineries, and they don't explain themselves as to why.
So they'd rather just wave their hands and say, no, don't look over there.
That's exactly what they do. And unfortunately, legislators tend to go, I won't look there as long as you keep bringing me these piles of money. So we actually have litigation now in Texas where we're challenging a law there that allows – Texas retailers to ship to Texans, but excludes out-of-state retailers from shipping to Texans. And we have oral arguments in that important case on September 21st. And arguing our case for us will be Ken Starr.
Oh, wow.
And he was also – most people know who Ken Starr is, but what they may not know is that Ken Starr was the person who argued in front of the Supreme Court in the wine lawsuit, Granholm v. Heald, which was eventually
won. That's awesome to have him representing them because it's like he knows the arguments and he's...
There's a lot of good reasons to have Ken Starr arguing this case. He's a Texan to begin with.
That's always
helpful.
Good. Yeah.
He's a constitutional expert. That's good. He's familiar with wine law, clearly.
So he should be... He's familiar with Texan law and wine law. And
he's also familiar with Texans.
Yeah.
Which is important,
don't mess
too.
With Texas, as they like to say.
That's an interesting state, I must say.
Yeah. Okay, wow. So that's... Oh, boy, that was a whirlwind.
Not just that. You know, if you're worried about the community of Sonoma and Napa Valley and the people listening on the internet understanding this, my understanding is that the people who listen to KSVY are very, very intelligent. They think about these issues on a complex level. So I don't think we're talking over anybody's head.
No. But at the same time, it's one of those arguments that it's clear that there's lots of there's lots of work still to be done, but there's also kind of these weird forces at work against each other.
It is a very, very complex subject. When you boil it down to what this all means is that there is a group of people across the United States who are more than happy to screw consumers for their own benefit, and they're really good at that.
Yeah. You're listening to Wine Biz on KSVY 91.3 on your FM dial, or as we would like to say, ksvy.org on your internet dial. And phones are still open. Boy, man, I can't believe how many phone calls we've gotten today. The number to call is 933-9133. If you want to talk to me or Tom Wark, or you want to just air whatever grievance you've got, And if you're outside the area, it is 707-933-9133. And, if you have long distance, a lot of folks these days have long distance that's just unlimited minutes. So you can call. You can call from anywhere in the country. Yeah, no big deal. So... Wow, that was wild. So actually, I know that you have other arguments about the Granholm case, about how kind of analogies to let people kind of understand what the distinction is between this. I know that you actually mentioned it in your blog.
Mm-hmm. The biggest battle that retailers have across the country is that wholesalers would make the argument that the Granholm v. Heald Supreme Court decision that allowed wineries to ship direct doesn't apply to retailers because retailers were not specifically mentioned in that decision. But you take Brown versus Board of Education, which most people are familiar with. Brown v. Board, which I believe was issued in 1954 by the Supreme Court, it said that separate but equal facilities, school facilities, are unconstitutional. Now, Brown, in that case, was a little girl, a little black girl who was prohibited from going to a particular school. She had to go to it was a black school in Kansas. That case didn't mean that you could still discriminate against Hispanics.
Or Asians or anybody else. Ethnic group, yeah.
You've got New York Times v. Sullivan, and this was a case in which the Supreme Court said that a company may not sue the media if they may not sue the New York Times if the New York Times accidentally got a fact wrong. Well, that doesn't mean that you can sue a radio station or you can sue a television station, just not the New York Times.
Right.
So what's happening here is the people who are trying to protect their own interests, the wholesalers, are interpreting this case in the most narrow fashion possible for their own ends.
Sure.
So, which is common.
Clearly.
Yeah. I mean, again, let's face it. If I was a wholesaler and there was a law that said that all the wine in the state had to come through us first.
Of course, I'd spend what it takes. Yeah.
I would spend what it takes, but it doesn't do much for consumers.
No, I have to agree with that. I'm generally speaking a pretty much laissez-faire. I'm good with people just doing what they want to do. And so, you know, when hearing that, you know, there's a group of guys, and you always envision it as like this smoky back room guys with big stogies, and they're like, we'll fix that wine, you know.
I don't know if they still smoke or not.
Well, who knows? Yeah, you know, but it's the image that comes to mind. That's the trouble.
No, it does. But, you know, we live in a really different society now where the expectations of consumers have changed completely over the past 10 years. Today, every consumer has the expectation that they'll be able to go on the internet, do a search for the products they want, find them, and have them ordered, and UPS or FedEx will drop them off at their door. And this includes wine. You can now go on the internet and you can search for a very specific wine, and you can go to websites that'll show you which retailers are featuring or have this wine in inventory and exactly what they're charging. And what it's done for consumers is it's really flattened out the market. You can see exactly what the best price on it is, and this is a true benefit to consumers. They can find what they want now. They're able to engage in a kind of commerce they weren't able to engage in 15 to 20 years ago. 15 to 20 years ago, you relied on your good local wine retailer to have a nice selection to point you in the right direction, and most people were happy with that.
Sure. But, I mean, that was before kind of the explosion of, like, you know, people would come out to Sonoma, and they, you know, they would – or to Napa or any, you know, Paso Robles or any of the other areas that, you know, that make great wine, and they'd be like, wow, how do I get this? And and if they're in a state that does – their distributor just doesn't – it doesn't get on the radar, they'd be out of luck.
That's right. That's
and what more? Wouldn't it be the case that they couldn't buy it in California and ship it to themselves?
That's not completely true. A law was passed, or maybe it was an executive decision actually by Bush after 9/11, that allowed people to carry wine or have wine shipped to them rather than put it on the airplane. They didn't want liquids and stuff in the hull. So there's some wiggle room there. But, you know, what happened in the early 90s was we had this explosion of wineries. Such an explosion that the distributor network really couldn't handle all these wines. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of these wineries, they built into their business plan this notion of direct sales to consumers. And they worked it. They built their websites
Or mailing lists.
Or mailing lists, you know. And in the cases where they had tasting rooms, they were able to collect names in that way. And they worked the email. And this whole other channel for wine distribution and wine sales really opened up and exploded. And that coincided with the wholesalers saw that. And they saw all this wine that was not going through them anymore.
Right.
That was bypassing them. And that's what led to the original felony laws in places like Texas and Florida, where they convinced the legislatures to enact felony legislation where you could get the same amount of time in jail for shipping a bottle of wine in the state of Florida as you could for raping someone in Florida.
Wow. That just does not seem kind of – it doesn't add up. In fact, I was just thinking while you're talking about this business model, I'm envisioning Kaz. I mean, Kaz doesn't sell to distributors.
Kaz is a perfect example.
He's got his own tasting room, very small. I mean, you've been there, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And he sells everything out of that or over the internet. You know, he doesn't need the distributor network to do his. He's so small, he wouldn't even get on their couldn't get their attention.
No, that's right. I mean, well, if people tasted Kaz's wines, I mean, sure, there's some distributors out there who might want to carry them. I mean, they're very, very good wines, but Kaz chooses to sell direct. That means that if he prices his wine at $25, he gets $25 for that bottle of wine. And why shouldn't he? It's the bottle of wine that he produced. It was his labor. It was his investment. It was his vision. If he sells to a wholesaler, you know what he has to sell his $20 bottle of wine to them for?
What, like $15 or
$10.
$10. Holy $10.
Cow. So there's some incentive to want to sell wine direct, as any winery who's listening to this will understand. But I think that wineries also should be able to sell their wines directly to retailers and to restaurants in any state.
Sure. That's the direct-to-trade aspect of things, right, in terms of – and I know that one of your other clients, Inertia Beverage Group, does they've got a platform of an offering that basically allows wineries to kind of set that sort of thing up for
themselves. That's right. In California, a winery can sell directly to a retailer or a restaurateur. They don't have to sell their wine first to – a wholesaler, but in most other states, you can't sell directly to a restaurant or a retailer and go around the wholesaler. There was a lawsuit in Washington recently based on the Granholm Supreme Court decision, and the conclusion of that lawsuit was that a state, Washington State in particular, may not allow its in-state Washington wineries to sell directly to retailers, which it did, but prohibit out-of-state wineries from selling directly to retailers. So now, California wineries, Oregon wineries, Michigan wineries, New York wineries may in fact sell directly to retailers and restaurateurs in Washington if they choose to. This is groundbreaking.
That's crazy.
I mean, it truly is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, everything's changing.
Yeah, no kidding. It's a brave new world, definitely. You see, in fact, it always reminds me that the power of the internet and direct sales has just kind of exploded. And I know that it's taken, you know, it's only been, I mean, what, a 13 years now that the internet's actually kind of really existed as a even kind of resembling a commercial, you know,
right.
Channel. And just seeing how, even in the last 10 years, how far it's come to where, yeah, exactly as you say, is like you go to Google, you go to products, you can type, you know, search for wine in any number of ways. And
right.
If you just know a few good online websites for locating. Now, actually, during the break, you actually mentioned one that
yeah.
was a good place to search for.
Well, first of all, I do all my wine shopping at the Wine Exchange and Taylor and Norton.
he'd just like to say that for the record.
However, when they don't have the wines I like, one of the best sites on the internet is something called winesearcher.com. It's W-I-N-E hyphen, I believe, searcher.com. And you go to this website and you type in 2000 Kaz Mourvedre. And all of a sudden, it'll list all of the retailers in America that actually carry that particular wine, and it'll list the price they're charging. And what that's done is it's really flattened out wine pricing across the country, and it's an enormous benefit
to
consumers.
You can totally see how that's a benefit to consumers because literally the fact that consumers can see what the prices are at all these different retailers, suddenly there's no kind of like, oh, well, you know, you buy it from me, you got no other choices, so...
Right.
And as soon as they say, well, over here, I'll just buy it over there. And the only thing that starts to, and it's a typical online a problem with online sales is kind of figuring in automatically the cost of shipping with the price that you're seeing.
That's
because
right.
a lot of folks, you know, you'll be like, oh yeah, I'm getting such a great deal. I'm only paying you know, $5 a bottle for this bottle of wine, but you know, yeah, but you got to tack on $25, $30, $40 for shipping and quote handling, and that immediately can erode the value of the purchase.
In fact,
too.
Buying online is almost never cheaper than buying locally. What the internet allows for is access to wines that are not available in your market. And what's interesting too is in some cases these sorts of wine search engines haven't necessarily flattened the market. You can go online to winesearcher.com and search on a 1997 Robert Mondavi Reserve Cabernet, and you'll find that the cheapest one that you can find is going to be $150.
Or,
and then you'll see it for $175, $180. And then someone in New York is charging $210, and somebody down in Florida is charging, you know, $250. And you think to yourself, wow, don't you love the internet?
Yeah, no kidding. I was also thinking like, oh, yeah, you go out and search for Kosta Browne or something
oh,
like
sure,
that.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Like, you know, any wine that you know has a big buzz and
mm-hmm.
and you know that you're not going to be able to find it locally. Or you're
That's
not gonna
right.
be able to find it at your local retailer because heck, they sold out a long time ago. So
that's yeah. exactly it. Yeah.
yeah,
it's a new world for wine consumers, and it's a good world too. But what we have to do is we have to straighten out these laws so that consumers can really take advantage of the tools that they now have.
Very cool. Yeah.
yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm done. I don't got nothing else. It's like 7 minutes. What do you want to talk about?
What would Kaz talk about if he were here?
He would, Kaz, you know what Kaz would do right now is he would probably pick up one of his sheets of paper and talk about what is good to put in a compost pile.
We all know what's
good. I love Kaz, man. It's like he's got some of the, and the worst situation that Kaz ever gets in is if he's alone in this booth and he has to talk for an hour, he just loses
his mind. He'd be able to do that.
Yeah, normally I think he could, but I don't know what it is, but he sits down. If he's by himself, man, it just, it. yeah, it unravels. And he will be the first to tell you that, too.
Well, you know, right now, though, would be a good time to have Kaz here because the harvest is just starting to really get underway here, which and that means best wishes all you winemakers out there and all you wine widows, too.
I know,
because it's
yeah.
really going to start to get hefty pretty soon. The SB is coming in. I was over in Napa early last week, and they were starting to bring in Sauvignon Blanc. They're starting to bring in Sauvignon Blanc this week, you know, and then Chardonnay's going to come and Merlot's going to come. And so far, it looks like it's been a pretty good year out there, fairly steady in terms of weather.
That's in fact, last week I mentioned that, you know, Mum actually put out a press release saying, oh, look, we've started our harvest.
Well, for sparkling wine, right?
For sparkling, yeah, of course. It's like, you know, obviously for sparkling wine, you pick early because you want higher acidity.
Right.
You don't need as much sugar. But the point of it was, is that, you know, the comment by the winemaker, was that, you know, this year has really been pretty much ideal for growing. I mean, it's just, it hasn't been too hot, hasn't been too cold, nice cool evenings, you know, foggy mornings, that sort of stuff, but nice warm days, not so hot that the grapes, you know, end up losing sugar over the...
It seems like it's always been somewhere in the mid-80s for the last 3 or 4 months. I mean, in June we had that little weird heat spike, July, 4th of July, I think it was. We had but it was nothing like 2006 in June.
Where it was like a week of just crazy 115s and.
Exactly. In my backyard in Glen Ellen, I took the thermometer out there, looked, and it said 115 degrees. And the last time I had ever experienced anything close to that was Vegas. But I didn't have any air-conditioned casino to walk back into.
No.
That was a problem. We didn't have air conditioning either, and that was one weird night, too, I got to tell you. 115?
Yeah, in a strange turn. Well, it wasn't a strange turn. It was a fortunate turn for me. Actually, we had just moved up here the week, like the Thursday that we moved up was the first day that it was like really, really super hot. And then we packed up and we went to San Diego for 2 weeks. And so San Diego was like 80 degrees,
perfect,
kind of foggy. It was like, and of course, you heard all these reports about the record temperatures up here. Yeah. And I was just like, boy, I wonder what all the poor people are doing.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, actually, it was in June 2006. It was the very first time in my life I was ever actually able to fry an egg on a sidewalk. And I'd always wanted to do that. But I don't recommend you do it on concrete. You know why?
Why?
Very hard to get off.
I believe it. Yeah, you know, that porous surface. It
exactly.
Just, you know, yeah, you put the pan down on the. You know.
I had an egg stain there for at least 2-3 weeks.
Well, sure. Wow.
But anyway, good luck to all the winemakers out there. You know,
I know.
Go make some good wine.
It should be a great year. We're really looking forward to hearing more about it. I know that when Kaz comes in, it's going to be a couple weeks. He's like I said, he's out doing the football thing today, and I know that next Monday he's going to be out again. So you'll have to all listen to my voice. We'll see if we can get Skip Smith in here. You know, he's left Glory Ferrer is what we've heard. So,
what's he going to do?
I don't know. Kaz told me, and I can't remember now. And it was – oh, no, that's right. He's going to work for Jacuzzi.
Oh, across the street. Okay.
So it's like, oh, that's a big move.
I went into Jacuzzi a couple weeks ago. What a nice facility.
I know. Actually, I had been in there the weekend it opened, and the weekend after it opened, and we took a look around. It was
that whole stretch now is really becoming in sort of almost a destination because
it's like the Las Vegas Strip. It's getting to be like that.
It's fun, actually. My wife and I every now and then on a weekend we'll say, oh, let's go to Alexander Valley, but. I don't. A couple of weeks ago, we decided, oh, let's go down to this neck of the woods in Carneros, and we started with Vianza. Then we went to Jacuzzi. We stopped at the fruit stand. We went down to Cornerstone.
The gardens. Down
the gardens.
Did you go to Klein Cellars or any of the?
We didn't. No, we only had so much time. There's so much to do. We went to Gloria Ferrer. I couldn't convince her to stop in at the. What's the guy who makes the beef jerky? I just love it.
Oh, I know which one you're talking about. It's just on the side of the road.
Exactly. Yeah. So we spent a good, 4 or 5 hours just hanging out in that little strip of land down there. And we could still go back. We could still get the beef jerky. And we could still go to Klein and still not do what we had done before.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's becoming a nice little destination.
It has turned in kind of the Las Vegas strip of Carneros.
And then there's that new tasting room, too, at the Cornerstone Gardens. I mean, Rochambeau is in there. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they have, six. It's a co-optation. It was about 6 wineries in there.
That's cool. So that's like the wine room that's up in Kenwood.
Exactly,
like literally just a bunch of small wineries got together and said, hey, let's do a tasting room.
Yep.
Yeah, really. So. That's very cool. All right. So we've come to the time. So, Mr. Tom, thank you for your makeup day. You're off the hook this time.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah. And I think we'll have you on. It's only going to be probably a couple more weeks. I don't know. We'll see. I don't know what we're going to do for because I think the first Monday in September is, of course, Labor Day. And I don't know if we're doing a show or not.
I'm off the hook, right?
Well, we'll talk.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So you've been listening to Wine Biz on KSVY 91.3. And this is Randy giving you the outro, we will give it to you right now where we say bottoms up.